Townsville is named after my great grandfather. So in 1913, I was born. I'll let Whipper introduce himself.
My name's Tom Bissett. I was born in New Zealand in 1917 and landed here just about the end of 1917 with an old mining family, a Scotch family. My father had mined coal in Canada, Africa, New Zealand, and we came over here just after the war finished. And we've been ever since, most of all then. I attended the school up here, and right from infancy, represented them in football and athlete in Sydney, Newcastle, and I went into the mines to work. Well, first of all, I went up to see Monk Weymouth, they call it, up here in Seahampton, looking for a job when I was 14, but that Christmas, that was 1931, I think it was, they raised the age limit from, you had to be at least 14 those years before, but about then on, they raised it, you had to be 16. Well, there was no hope of getting a job at that time, and that pit closed down a year or so after that. Is this what you're looking for?
Answer them in the right respect if we can. Mm. They ask those questions. I'm too happy to answer them.
Somebody got a question?
Yeah. How did it affect your family?
What is that?
How did it affect your family?
Oh, it did. It does affect the family a great deal in this respect that there's no money in those days. There was tokens handed out to put those into the store and get them out in over a various period of time, sort of the next fortnight. But going back a little bit, in the early days, back in the 20s, a little earlier than that, they used to say that was good old days. They weren't really. Now, how the people survived, they exchanged a terrible lot. Now, if somebody was, like you had fowls, somebody was short of eggs, it was passed over the fence. They, in turn, would pass a cabbage or lettuce, beans, whatever the case may be. There was a great exchange. But there's one important item which, in those days, which really happened, and not in these present days where people think themselves and themselves only, but in those days, they thought of their fellow neighbour, which is excellent. And as I said before, if they're short of anything, they certainly passed it over, and this is as how they survived in those days, because as I said before, there's no money around whatsoever. If you had a 2 bob, which was 20 cents at the present moment, in your pocket, you was a rich young fella.
Can we go back a little ways and ask Tom a question? Did you get a job at Monk Weymouth or Seaham?
No. It was years and years later on. It was about 1934. We went out, I used to push a bike out to Rhondda Colliery, my mate and myself, and we said to go and get a horse out the stable, harness it, take it over and hook it onto the wagon, take it halfway to Cockle Creek, and emptied out a 7-ton of chitter, then reversed the procedure and put the horse back in the stable. We got 2 shillings each for that. And that was like just casual work. And that went on, really, till about 1937, when we got a job on pit top. 8 hours work, at 8 and 4 pence a day I started that, for the 8 hours work. And you had to pay your union out of that, your hospital, your ambulance, and doctor. Well, when the pits weren't working full time, you might only get 2 or 3 days a fortnight. And I have seen the time when we had to take money out there to pay our union, which was around about 5 bob a fortnight at that time. But you have to keep that going, see?
Which mines were... The Depression started in about 28 in Westie, and as you can hear, people weren't getting permanent jobs till the late 30s, so it lasted as much as 10 years around here. What sort of what mines were operating before 1928 here?
Well, the There was a lot of what they call rat holes. We're getting a few days' work here and there. But the most of the big mines, as I say, seam number one closed down early in the 30s. Seam number two out here, the shaft they used to call it, it was working around about 3 days a week as the work come in good. Then there was Killingworth wasn't working at all at that time. It had blew up earlier on and it never started again. And there was Black's Colliery down here at Bullaroo. It was working. And that's about all. And Rhonda, it was working a few days a week. And on the other side of the hill, there was Pacific and a little colliery called Gart Lee. They were working around about 2 or 3 days a week, that kind of business. And that's about the main mine that was here at that time. The Stockington had worked years ago, Stockington number one, but it had closed down and it hadn't opened at that time. It never opened until about, just before the war, wasn't it?
Yeah, just before the war.
Just before the war it opened.
So with all this closure, was Westfall's then, was this area dependent on coal mining for income?
That's right. There were only 13 people at one part of the heights of the Depression. There was only 13 people working in Westfall then. Those were the school teachers, bank managers, etc., you know.
So the whole population, bar those few service industries, were dependent on mining?
That's right, definitely.
Can I add a little bit more to that? They didn't entirely depend on the mines. There was quite a few people that worked in the heavy industries, that's in the fly sites, steelworks, Jude and Lloyd's, those places. Young Green used to run a bus from here into those areas, morning and night, all in their shift work rather. Now can I go a little further? Now, I can go back in 1927, that's when I started work really. And I was one of very few in Holmes that was working at the time. As the witness said, he was getting 8 and 9 ripens or whatever it is a day. Well, I was getting 18 and 6 a week in those particular years. Now, in my fourth and fifth year, my dad and mum couldn't receive the dole because I was earning so much money. So I kept the family on the fourth and fifth year apprenticeship, which I wasn't too happy as far as the government was concerned. I didn't mind doing it, don't get me wrong. But a young fellow to be apprenticed and have to keep the family.
Yeah,
well,
pretty
right. Was actually earning $1.85 a week, which was too much.
Did the Depression like hit this area earlier than it hit the other places around here? Did it hit like mostly because it depended on the mines?
Countrywide, but around this area, it did hit the mining district pretty early, didn't it?
Yeah, that's going back in the early days. When I said I started work, that was back in Jack Lang's day, he was a premier. Now we did the whole state was the same all over Australia. It was no different anywhere else.
It sounds like it was worse in Westie, because if Whitler was saying there were 13 people working at one time, that's much more than 33% unemployment. There must have been 70 or 80% unemployment in Westfall's end.
Oh, yeah.
Well, sorry, I mentioned, I was practically the only one in Parliament that was working at the time, in 1927.
Is there a reason why Westie got hit so badly? Because in the rest of Australia, the average was about 30%, and obviously it was much more here. Was there any reason why Westie copped it so badly?
Well, transport was one of the problems. Now, the young people, well, most of them, if you had a push bike, you were very fortunate. And there's a push bike job to run around looking for work. And to go to some places, which was pretty awkward at times, and as far as walking, we used to call it Shanks's pony, we walk. Well, it was out of the question, so it was pretty hard for this locality, because it was right out of the way from Wall's End and Newcastle area. So we're in the more or less the blocks well set apart.
You said Young and Green had a bus. Was that a normal bus or an old charabang?
Well, charabang.
No, it was a charabang. Now, I don't know whether anybody would recognise or know what a sharabang is.
No.
Well, you ever seen a Tira car? It had the fabric hood on it, the old ones. Well, this was something similar to that, only it could be 40 foot long. Not 40 foot long, but 25 foot safe, 25 foot long. And they had seats right across, but the back seats, one faced the other. But there was no glass of protection in the on the sides. They used to have to pull a curtain down to rain. And the bus boy, he walked on what they call the footboard on the outside to collect the fares. So you really got to, on the footboard, open the door to get in. That was just
was like the, a big... was the tram line operating during the Depression?
It closed down about 1931 or 32. You used to come along here, along the back here.
Okay, I'll relate on that too. Oh, I have rode in the Sailor's Whipper too. From West Falls then, up to the football ground here, that's where it terminated. The steam tram, from there to Wall's End, it used to cost a penny for a year under eight, wasn't it?
Mm.
But if you're, no, 14. And if you're over that, it cost you fourpence to Wall's End. You changed Wall's End to catch the steam tram to go to Newcastle, which are another fourpence. And then, really, I don't know whether you know what a purway is. That's where the railway line goes. That is what they term in those days, a purway. Now, that purway with the tram, it came right up through this, where the school is sitting there now. And across the road, just down there a little bit, and went up this side of Estival. There was a stop there, Sandiola, and kept right through to Wall's End, of course.
So, during the late 20s, was there a tram line and a train line?
Yeah, the train line was the Caledonian Company. They joined up with our main company, but they used to run a train with a couple of carriages. And it used to leave at 7 o'clock in the morning and take those that was working and could travel that way down to Cockle Creek. And then they used to catch whatever train or bus or whichever way they were going. And it used to ride back here about 5 or 5 in the afternoon. Or used to leave Cockle Creek, I should say, about 5 or so in the afternoon. But that never went to... When this bus started, Johnson... It was the Bluebell, they used to call that bus.
They came after you.
When it started, the train ceased. It was really the cause of the train season. And the tram, it never lasted long after that neither.
So did Westy have better links with Newcastle 60 years ago than it does today? Because today, the young people have only got a bus to get in.
No, you got a better linkage today than you did in those days. They've brought... With the new roads, they have brought Newcastle much closer to West Wall's End. But the roads in those my days was all practically gravel. But there were no shortcuts.
So do people at Westie see themselves as Novocastrians or as people from West Wall's End? Like, was it considered to be a very different town?
Oh, well, in the local area, they always was West Wall's End people, you know. But statewide, they was proud to be called Novocastrians, you see. But we still hold their title. Even today, you'll hear them say, Wall's End West, you know. Well, then they'll be picked up straight away. No, this is West Wall's End, a different town altogether than Wall's End. Edgeworth used to be called Youngie. It was short for Young Wall's End. And I think they always, you know, we're proud to be West Wall's End people.
Anybody got questions about? Yep.
What was your worst memory of the Depression?
The worst memories? Well, I seen my mother crying when there was no food in the family at all. This is what I can remember, this and always will. And we had to line up at the school with a mug in your hand to get soup. That was about the only meal you got. There was very, very little. But no one starved, as you understand, but everyone, it was sad to see those days. Everyone more or less was on the one foot No one could afford to throw anything away. And to see people and young people getting married, it was very, very sad. Nowhere to go, nothing to do. That was the worst part of it.
Well, really, I do support Whipper and what he mentioned there, but now, as far as butter, if we get about it that particular day, we used to use ribbon, and to make it taste, you put salt on that, to make it taste a bit different, but the next day you could use pepper, that's on your bread. But it was a sad day, so it's going back quite a long time for me to remember it really, but as I said, there's that much unemployment, and well, there was no money there for people to create any funds, although we did have a certain amount of it in our soccer days, or no rugby league days those, and playing certain games. But I couldn't say much about it, but just don't remember much of it really, some of it.
Well, I used to go on the Baker cart on school holidays, and a Saturday morning, we'd be in Minmai 5 o'clock. Used to sit in the cart and be beating the corn bag. In the cold winter days, the frost was that thick, you know, and had no boots. You went to school with no boots. The girls went with no shoes. And I used to deliver bread to those people in Minmai, and they were a proud people too. But some of the homes that I'd walked into, you wouldn't have seen any past. As far as poverty was concerned, not only Minmai, Westie, Killingsworth, to go and see how the people carried on, it was amazing. You know, the things they had to do to survive. But somehow people did come through it. And as those young people grew up, I think it made a better sort of human being of them. They stuck together, all that class of people, my age group, Ernie's age group, they said, all stick together, all through their life, haven't they, Ern?
Oh, yes, they have.
There's a mateship. There's no carrying on like they do today. When it wasn't game, you were whacking the ear pretty quick off the local policeman in them days. Now, if you went home and told your father, he'd give you another whack. But we'd never be able to misbehave at school, did we, Ern?
No.
But,
he used to have the cane those days.
Yeah.
He used to get what they call six cuts. Put your hand out. If you didn't hold it out properly, he left the cane up into the fingers. You get six of those on your hand.
I'd rather have six cuts any day than 100 lines.
Were any people evicted from their homes in Westie because they couldn't pay rent?
Very few.
Very few. It happened elsewhere. There were shanty towns
at
Plattsburgh and in town.
Yeah.
No evidence of that
here.
Oh, it
could have been, but
very, very, very.
There wasn't many either. As I said, there was very little money around, and where was anyone going to get any money to let other people come in the house? Because there was no money at all. But in those particular days, if you took a loan out and you couldn't pay the house off, you lost everything. The money you paid off the house, everything was lost. But
lost
these days
the
now,
too.
If you take a loan out and you can't pay your house off, they sell the house and they take what's owned of them and you get the rest back. But not in our day, they took the whole lot.
Questions?
Yep.
What did
you see during Depression? What was
your
life?
Well, mainly it was all home cooked. Those that could make bread, the women, and a lot of the women in the district here made their own bread. You grew your own vegetables, you swapped around with your neighbours. More or less like barter system. You went out in the bush, you got blackberries, or blackberry jam, pies, anything was going at all. And you went fishing down the lake, you could push your bike down, and there was plenty of fish in the creek in those days down there. But none of this fancy stuff at all. It was just all plain food to survive. Trap a few rabbits, things like that. But there was no money to buy anything. So you only got coupons to go and get your food. So much meat. another coupon for so much milk, another coupon for so much groceries. A single man at that time, he was getting 6 bob a week. That was his dole. So he wouldn't do much on that. Of course, bread was only about 3 and 4 pence a loaf. But you, all what you ate was more or less basic food. And it was better. There wasn't so much ulcers and things like that in the stomachs about in those days because the food was plain. But there was a lot of people suffered with boils and carbuncles through a deficiency in the diet. Yeah.
What did you do as pastimes in the Depression?
Well, football, we used to play soccer in that park there every night. We had our own local soccer teams and there were Sunday competitions with the likes of Walls End, Owensville here, Minmai, and there was plenty to do, you had nothing to do but to run around the bush, things like that, you see, trapping birds. Never had much time to chase girls, did we? But we had nothing else to do back, playing football and things like that, see. And in the summertime, we used to walk down to the Salty. And at Salty the other day, I just think about last night, there was 2 shops there, and I seen it was Sunday afternoon, maybe 300 or 400 people there, swimming. But most of those people were walking there. Yeah. In those days, or bikes or something like that.
Sandy, they used to call it.
It's Sandy, by the way, Salty Creek.
What's Salty Creek look like now? What
sort of
fish did you catch out of Salty Creek then?
Oh, beautiful brim. I used to catch these silver biddy, that would be a big one. A 6 inches long would be a big brim, silver biddy. But he used to get mullet, darky, and nice brim, Cajun flathead, things like that.
Do you catch those things now?
You can get mullet.
The sewage
works, so you can't
eat
them.
Eels.
Jane
fishing at the sewage in Salty Creek. There'll be too much cadmium and lead in the... There is now.
Right up at the Weir. This will be about 30-odd years ago. This new Australian, I probably remember from down there, he knows where he came from. He caught this big ewe. He couldn't handle it. He tied up with a bit of rope or wire and went home and get his mate. And when he got back, the eels that took to it. About 56 pounds. Ewe, they used to come right up to the Weir down there. Okay.
What were the main gathering points around Westie, like halls or clubs or pubs or whatever? Where did people gather?
Well, there was no club at all. The men that could afford it, that wasn't very often either. They go down to the local pub, see, there was 4 hotels in the town.
Where were they?
Well, there's 2 in the main street. What they call La Chaparral, that was the Royal Hotel. And then there was the Clyde Inn. There was another one round in Wilson Street, the Northumberland. It's a residential place now. And then there was the Museum Hotel down near the football ground.
And the Holmesville Pub too?
The Holmesville Pub,
yes.
Yeah. Killingworth Pub. Rhonda Hotel.
Minmai
Hotel, yeah. There was a couple of hotels in Minmai.
There was 11 hotels in Minmai many years ago.
What about the School of Arts? Was that an important building?
Yeah, it was.
It was an important building in West Falls End, yes.
Very important.
Yes, sir.
It had a beautiful reading room. That's where the men used to go and there was like all the papers, the London, Illustrated London News, the Sydney Mail, and those sort of magazines.
Who's seen the School of Arts in West Falls End, the main street? Yes, it's almost condemned. In fact, it's been condemned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you should find a little bit about it because it's very important focal point. It had a balcony on top.
Can I relate about that too? They had a balcony out at the front. Now, it was the, what they call the dining, not a dining room, but where they used to hold their functions for having meals.
Supper room,
actually, they call it a supper room. Now, the School of Arts, it's one place, there's not many of them around, could hold three functions in it. You had the upstairs, and you had the lower floor, and you had another one at the side at the back. So three functions you could have. Now, getting back to the balcony on the front, I bought that, and I pulled that off. Now, the boards that went around the front of that was American redwood. It was 2 feet wide, by 1 inch thick, and 15 foot long, and there was five of them. And had West Fallsend School of Arts printed on those boards in big letters. So I still have some of those boards up there that I used for scaffold planks. They're 12 inches wide. I ripped them down the centre since. Now the timber in the ceiling of it was all dressed Oregon. As the Yankees call it, Douglas fir. I was really the chap that pulled that front off the School of Arts. That's from back in the early days.
There's the fellow. I'm still on the board's request for this School of Arts written on
it. I haven't. Well, if they're in halves now. I have two of them up there. The son had one over his place, took them to me, and I've had a lot of gorge windows and doors out of these, because it's great stuff for.
I won't ask you to put them in the museum.
No, you can't.
I think we should stay here for a little bit and finish up the slide. Any other questions about depression? You don't have a test to go through right now, do you? You can think some questions you might get to stay for a little bit, yes?
Really bad. The young married women was having children. They were given a special coupon for milk. But that was about the only assistance other than the dole. I can't remember any goals. It was a very low position to be in. The whole country was in the same position, but there was no other assistance.
I can add a little bit more to that too. There was assistance in far as material is concerned, and some of that material was received from the government. You wouldn't, it was like, ever seen Eschen or Bag? It was nearly as bad as that. You couldn't wear it. It was only there for making sofa covers and stuff like that. This is the stuff the government issued out, which was very poorly indeed.
Was there a name for that? Did they have a nickname for it?
No, they didn't have a nickname. I couldn't. Some of those names, you couldn't repeat.
There's so many unemployed people in West Fallsend. Was there union or industrial action, or riots or demonstrations here?
Oh yes, they were all throughout. Now even Tom might remember this, because he wasn't in it at the time. Even in West Fallsend, Peter Pitt, Colliery up here. They had what they, I know where you know what a scab is. He's a chap who worked for less wages while everybody else is off work. They've even had soldiers up here to protect them in West Fallsend Minor, West Fallsend. That's going back in the early days.
So they had union lockouts here and scab labour was brought in?
That was brought in when the Rothbury trouble that was on in 1930.
Mr. Brown got shot.
Yeah. The West Fallsend, I remember that well. When old Bob Johnson pinched the bus from the local store, and had about 40 or 50 blokes on it, and they went to Ashtonfield, and the police thought that's where the trouble was going to be. There was scabs working there too. But that was only a course of diversion. The main mob from Cessnock, they went straight to Rothbury. That's where the trouble started, where Brown was shot. I was up at his commemoration of his 50th year since he was shot there a few years back. He's buried in I think it's Greta Cemetery, that fella. But in the town itself, there wasn't much that went on. Right to that in the town locally itself, but as things moved on a little bit, they brought the return soldiers' preference in. That was, men had gone to the First World War, although they were all on the one level, a few of them in the town here took on, and they took the return soldiers' preference, which caused a lot of bitterness. But so much, there was a battle fought up here between Westie and Seahampton. You know, about halfway where that big cutting is they're putting in the road there now, that was the Butcher Birds ground there. We used to play soccer on that when we was kids, and cricket. Used to meet at Seahampton, and generally end up in a cow dung fight anyhow, but there was a battle there one time, about 40 or 50 men. And that was about the only bitterness that I've seen locally around here in my life.
What were they there fighting with?
Was
it
fisty cups?
Always
fist. I was up in the fork of a tree watching the coppers game. They're only about 14.
We're all in those fist fights. Well, that's when I fought Star Carroll from CM, a fairly large dark chap, after night school. It's true what he done to me, and he couldn't take it, but I beat him. But I still don't know who got the worst out of it. I still got me puzzled. So we both got a belt.
So these fights followed some sort of unspoken rule, did they? There were no weapons, just fisticuffs.
No weapons, no.
They were clean, there's no feet either, no kicking.
Anyone who kicked a man in those days, he was an outcast.
Yeah, no way.
You might bring your foot in here.
After
having a fight at school, would you go and
get
a fight from your parents? They're talking about fighting as adults, I think. What was the question again?
I was
asked,
at school, when
you was
in school, if you had a
fight
at school,
would
you go and get another
fight
from your parents?
Or, well, the teacher. Now, Bill Raw and them, they're all pretty fair men. They get the gloves out and make you put the gloves on. And you put it out in the school in front of all the boys. That was the way, wasn't it? I told Bill Raw and them that.
That's just good. They're still after.
Yeah. Well, just depends what size you are, really.
There was no feet, though. They didn't keep. No way. How many years of feet are you? Well, that's it, karate and...
You've got a question, unless you guys wanted to start talking about it.
Well, you can relate that to Mr. Bizzard, because he can go back, right back in the days, the early mining, when it was done by hand. So, if any questions on mining, if you don't mind, relate to Mr. Bizzard, be right.
Now, what did you wear underground when you were mining?
Well, just a pair of long pants and your pit boots, hobnail boots, and many of the places, well, it was that hot, that's all, never wore any singlet or anything. A lot of times that later on, just depending on like where you were, you'd wear shorts, and it's only your shorts and your boots. The different pits they were in, some pits it was cool, you see, and you'd wear a shirt and that, but most miners wore what they call a flannel shirt. You see, the steel workers used to wear a flannel shirt for the same reason. You never got cold with a flannel shirt. So when you was mining that, you sweated profusely with the humidity of the mine, and the shirt, just like beads of sweat all over the outside of it. But being flannel, you were never cold. You never caught a cold with a flannel shirt on, and you never felt cold. Even in the out in the bush in the early days, in the cold weather, the old bagman, the swagman, they'd soak their shirt in the creek or their blanket in the creek and wring it out and put it on. It was a cold night and it kept them warmer than a dry shirt. But that's all you wore. And you had your, it was only a, those days it was a rag cap. We used to wear a carbide light or a tallow lamp, you know. That's a, that's all your clothing you wore.
How did a carbide light work?
Well, the carbide light had a bottom on it. It would be about that round. I could, next time when you come up, I could branch one up. And it was filled with carbide, little granules, about a quarter inch, roughly about a quarter inch square of that. And on top of that, that screwed onto a top, which was a reservoir with had water in it. And there was a little gadget on it that you'd twist it over and it drops of water. Just every now and again there would be a drop of water and you lit it with a match, you see. But where I worked was wasn't a flammable pit at the time. And that would last you for about 2 hours. You see, then they had a flint on the side. You put your hand over like that. Well, if you have one of those, that was the modern ones, you see. And they did it for about 2 hours. You always carried a little tin with you. And as you light, you knew when your light was about going out, you just undo it and dump it out and then refill it, spit in it, and turn it on again and away you go again for another 2 hours. You always kept your tank on top full of water. That's your water bottle. You had to cart your own water with you. In a water bottle, see? And many a time, even when I was a clipper boy, we were about 2.5 miles from the surface, that was the length of the tunnel down, coming out of a night, would be a horse or so in front of us, driving, fill another refill of carbide. You'd just hang on to the horse's tail or the breeching strap. You could come out all that way without filling your light again, so you save a refill of carbide. The horses knew the way out, even in the total darkness. They'd come out.
Were they unsafe, those early lights? For example, what happened if they were
gas? Well, not in the pits where they were used, because they were like the Great Northern seam, Rhonda, Gartley, Pacific and those colleges, and a lot of these little places out here where the ventilation was good, they were quite safe enough. But you couldn't use them in the seams or any place that was full of gas, so you'd just explode.
By the way, what I meant too with those lights, those carbide lights, they did produce gas, and this is what the light worked on. And as I mentioned before, they have this adjusting screw on the top of them to adjust them out of water for the size of flame you wanted coming out, or the bright the light. They had a reflector at the back of them. But in those early days, as Tom mentioned, they weren't in as far as what we are today, where you're 9 mile in at times. It was a short distance, and not only that, the air condition was not as good either. They had a shaft down, they used to light a fire at the bottom of the shaft, and that created the drew the air from the main tunnel into this fire and up at the shaft. It was a really old method. Remember that, Tom?
Yeah, well, I was in the furnace at Rhonda for about 6 months. I used to have to get my own coal and keep that big furnace going. I'd burn about, I think, up about 6 to 8 ton of coal a shift, 8 hour shift. And load your ashes and one thing and out the next day. And that fire was in the afternoon when the men was knocking off. It was banked, like you covered with slack, see? And threw a bit of water on it to damp it down, and that would just smoulder all night. And when you went in early in the morning, you went about an hour early, broke the bank and got the top of the coal going again, and it was really good ventilation. But the big furnaces was good.
Well, later on in the years, that one was saying, Tom, they had the steam come into power, and they had their steam fans then with the big engines. They had two of them. In case one broke down, I had to repair it. They had one either side of the big fan, and the fan could be 30 feet in diameter, which is quite a big fan. They received much better conditions as far as draft was concerned there. And this is something they do lack in the mines, and more so in the early days, is oxygen. See, we have not so great oxygen, you have humidity. And the humidity is, which is pretty heavy in the mines, and which is, it does knock the mines about. They do perspire profusely, and it's pretty hard on the time to try to work. And another thing, you've got to be used to be able to work in those conditions.
Well, I used to, the hottest mine I'd ever been in my life, I suppose I was summing up the other day, be about 52 or 53 mines I've been in. That was like when I was at the rescue station at Argentine there, with Stockton Borehole. And those seams in those days, I sent it down to 2'6" high, and tall men, the fellow up here was one of the tallest, old Henry Humphrey, remember? And they used to sit down on their, just on their haunches and mine the coal. The ponies were only about that high. They used to brush the roadways, that's between the, so the ponies could get in, the skips were only about that high. And it was remarkable, that was the hottest mine I was ever in. So it was hot.
No mind me, Tommy, they might know what brushing is. The brushing is taking part of the ceiling off, the height of the horse, to allow them to go through, because horses are not like goats, they can get down on their knees and crawl, but the horse, he stands on his 4 feet and stands upright. So they have to brush the ceiling to allow the horse to go through. Not much so much for his head, because the ears used to guide the height to put the head down. The touch of the ceiling, the head comes down. But the horse, that is brushing. It's brushing the ceiling down to allow the skips and the horse to go through.
They're only about that high. And the withers, you know, that'd be about the height of them ponies. Very small, but they used to do a mighty job. Yeah.
How did people actually mine in the early days? I mean, these days they use cutters and so on.
Yeah, well, at Stockton Borehole, it was all cut with a pick. You see, it was what they call a long wall. You never saw no coal till you got right to the face of maybe 3 mile in. It was all taken out in a big wall, and they had gateways, and the roof used to come down from the shaft. It used to just bend down and fell on until it reached the floor, you see. They had gateways through that. It was a safer way than what the board and pillar was in a lot of places. But if you had a bit of chalk, I can show you roughly how they used to do our seam there. The miners were roughly, was all on the pick. And so that's the roof of the mine. And that's the floor, you see. Now, that'll be the seam of coal, maybe 6 foot, whatever the seam is on. It just flows right through. There's all various seams here. The main seam around here is the Victoria Tunnel seam, the Australasian, the Great Northern, and the Borehole seams. And they all just like run in layers. So that's the surface of the earth. There might be one here, 3 foot, so it's 3 or 4 foot thick. The Great Northern in places is up 18 or 22 foot thick that way. Then you've got the Borehole seam, average around about 6 to 6 foot mainly. And then you've got other seams in between, little seams, you see. But at seam number two, that was the face of the coal. The miner just with a hand pick, he'd have to hold that in, you see, and he'd chop it in like that. And they'd throw the pick as far as they could throw it, and they'd cut that out like that there. You see, that'd be cut out. Then they used to put the shot holes in there, yeah, and blow that coal out, you see. That was what they called top hole. Now, in those days, I don't think there was any of the miners from CM number two came out there, they weren't dusted by the time they'd finished in their 60s and that. Men were all dusted. But see, there was bad ventilation. There was no water sprays at the face or anything in those days. And then the other pits had, instead of having the top hole, they had what they called bottom hole. And they used to lay on the floor on their side, and they'd pick in, it'd be about 6 yards across the width of the place, and they'd pick in the same and take a throw at it, throw the pick and lay and throw it as far, go right across the place, but they had to set what they call sprags there, I begin that to see, to stop that falling over. But when they got that in that right across the place, that they bore their holes in the top, three or four holes, and they'd shoot that down and load it away. Because you got that prop coming behind them all the way, you see.
Can I add a bit?
That was the hole method.
Can I add a little bit more to that too, Tom? I have no idea what they want to know too. Back in the early days, before powder was introduced, they'd bore the hole, because they had steel bits and whatever to be able to bore the hole, which Tonkin mentioned to you, as it was all borne by hand. But they used lime. Now, lime would come in rock form. They broke it down, they shoved that in, and they shoved a certain amount of water in, they plugged it up as quick as they can. And with the swelling of the lime, it pushed the coal out. It was a very slow method. I think you've heard of that. So, in those early days, before powder was produced.
What was that called?
That's the same as with Tom there. Instead of using powder, the lime was put in, and with the swelling, it was giving you pressure to shove the coal out. See, that big swelling of the lime with water. So instead of firing it out, it was pushed out by pressure.
Which system was the most dangerous, top hole or the bottom hole?
The bottom hole. See, many men got buried with the face coming over. So some places were, maybe 6 foot of coal, so well, there was a bit of a bump and over she'd come, you see.
Why did they ever bother doing bottom hole then, if top hole was safer?
Oh, well, sometimes in some scenes, was what they used to call the picking band, it might be softer up at the top 18 inches or so, than what the bottom bit was. If it was in Rhonda, we found out about 8 inches from the top, there was a soft 2-inch band of coal. That's where we bore our holes through that. That was when the raw hand bore. It would take you to run a 6 foot hole in, it would take you up to what, half an hour or so, just constant boring. You use three lengths of drill from one, you had a screw, and when that wound that first drill in, the number one drill would be about that long. You took, pulled that one out, reversed your screw, and shoved your number two drill in. So then you bored it in until you got the 6 foot in. But in the Rhonda, when they used the machines, that was like the face. The machine was here. It used to sum in. I don't know if the boys and girls have seen the coal cut machine. Well, it had a bar on it with all teeth in it, you see. Different shaped teeth. And it was driven by electricity. We used to make our own electricity at Rhonda. And that used to go round and round, you see. And the machine used to sit there and it used to sump in and it used to cut under the coal there in 6 foot. That would be about any up of around about 9 inches, I suppose. That there was cut out, you see. Well, all the miner done then, so that was looking at the other way, he drilled three holes in. It was a good ship then, you could drill three holes in there. Cross and shoot that, and that'll all come out. Might be 40, 50 ton of coal, so you'd have it all sit down, shoot down. Nowadays, you've got machines the plow and everything just goes right along. It might go 300 foot, just lay it on conveyor belts and all, see. But this is the old hand mining method.
How'd they pick this stuff up then after the machine went through?
Shovels. This here, in our days, it was just pick and shovel into skiffs. So to skip your rails, you laid your rails, you know, 6 foot length. When you went in that 6 foot, you put another 6 foot length of rail up, you see. Then after you got so many, the road layers would come behind, you know, put what they call bank rails. That was more permanent road, you see, 18 foot rails. But the skip would be here, you see, on the four wheels, and you just loaded that in by shovel. And we used to get Which is 2 6 a ton. That's 30 cents a ton. 2 6 a ton. And you'd have to buy a program, what they call a program, your powder was. It was 5 pounds of jelly knife, a coil of fuse, 10 detonators. That used to cost you 8 shillings. So you used to have to bore your holes, shoot the coal down, load it, throw any dirt or stone was in the bands of coal, and throw that back, set your timber, your rails, and it was 2 6 a ton. That's what you got for your labour.
So you weren't paid a wage, you were paid a commission on the coal you cut?
Yeah, it was like a contract. You were on a contract, see?
A contract miners, they call them.
You had to buy your own tools, buy your own powder.
Did you work your own shifts, or...?
No, it was 7 or 3, mainly the day shift.